Hi, this is Dan Williams, and you're listening to the Pocket Mentors podcast. This is a show that could not have been created without the help of all my amazing guests. They range from brand builders to therapists, from co-founders and founders to motivational speakers, from business mentors to managing directors and CEOs running their own businesses at this time. The one thing they've all got in common is that they're all facing their own challenges. They're going through the same ups and downs that you're about to experience. So they talk about their highs and lows, the journeys that have got them from A to Z, and how they've overcome all these incredible obstacles, and they've become resilient and come out stronger. They really want to share their stories with you to help you, whether or not you're creating your own business, your own brand, or if you're currently in your own business and you're facing your own challenges at this moment in time. I really believe that this podcast can help you no matter where you currently are with your life. So sit back, get on your bike, plug in your headphones, go on your run, start your cooking, whatever it is you're about to do by listening to this podcast, and enjoy.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Hi, very well. Thank you.
Good stuff. Thanks for coming on.
No worries. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, cool. If like no one's gonna know who you are, and I know we met at a like a careers panel at a high school. But if you want to just start from, I don't know, when you left school, and then how you've ended up creating this company that you've got, and then we can just chat about stuff on the way through, if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started in recruitment 8 years ago. Next month, so back in 2012. Worked for a firm for about 4 years, doing textbook recruitment stuff around the Leeds area, in kind of storage virtualization.
Did you want to get into recruitment? At what point did you think, there you go?
It's interesting because I think I mentioned to this to you on this one at the careers panel that if you looked at what I wanted to be when I was older, at every part of my academic career, it was always something out of an office. Never wanted to wear a suit. I basically didn't want to be my dad, who's an accountant. The whole thing just seemed really boring to me. But it wasn't until I'd done biomedical sciences at Leeds Met, and I'd quickly realised that I was in tons of debt, and the only thing that I wanted was money. I just wanted to clear the debt I had with the banks, and I was in debt with my dad because we had an arrangement where he would lend me the money while I was at university, but as soon as I had a job, I had to pay it all back.
Okay.
I just saw all this, and one of my best friends said to me, "Chris, you'd be really good at recruitment. You know, you're good at talking to people. You're social."
And were they in recruitment?
Sorry,
were they in recruitment themselves?
No.
Okay, that's a really funny career. Like, you'd be great at recruitment. Okay.
Yeah, they'd had an interview because I didn't even know really what it was. I applied to a couple of jobs, Yeah, two guys took me on, Amar Banabai, Stuart Hogg, and it kind of went from there, really. Joined another firm in 2016 for a couple of years, but wasn't totally sure on them.
Was that a big company or a small company?
It was a much bigger one, actually. They were a big London outfit, and they had a small Leeds office, and there was very much a satellite office feel about it. They had a great kind of set of values and culture, but that culture didn't quite translate into the regional teams.
That
was a bit of a friction.
Yeah.
So I decided to set up my own company with values.
Was there a friction from the London with the Yorkshire, or the Yorkshire, or just both on both sides?
Both, really. Oh. Yeah, and it's always difficult to get a culture to copy into another office.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the problem was, and people had different ideas of what the culture should have been. So it was difficult to really kind of get the team to go in one direction when there's two or three people pulling it different ways.
Yeah, sure.
So decided that I wanted to set up my own company. Needed to buy a house quickly to do that because I wouldn't have been able to get a mortgage without. I'd have had to be self-employed for 3 years. So quickly bought a house with my. She's my wife now, but she's my girlfriend at the time. And then the day that I got the keys to my house, I handed my notice into the firm I was at to start Finders in the January of 2018.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the catalyst? what was the catalyst during the time when you were at the other recruitment business?
I could just see things. They could be done better. Things around kind of values in recruitment is a big thing. So, you know, things like we get back to every candidate, which we did it at the other firm anyway, but then we also make sure that we go out and get that feedback to people who have been in the process and just be more conscientious around, you know, the well-being and time of the people that we work with. Candidates can be treated like commodities in my market, and it's terrible, and it's the reason why recruiters get such a bad reputation. I wanted to be a part of the movement. It's not something I've created. There's definitely an already movement going there of that values-driven recruitment thing. And I knew that I could do it better. So I went out and did it.
And did you do that on your own?
Yeah. Yeah, so originally it was just me for the first year. And I'd actually had my most successful year as a recruitment consultant in my first year of going alone.
Right, okay.
So decided to, Beth was kind of unhappy where she was at the time. So decided to bring her on to double our efforts. And now we work as a twosome, although she's been furloughed now. So it's just me again by myself.
It's such a strange time. So when you were working at the business you were at, and then you handed your notice in and you just started Finders, were you doing stuff behind the scenes to get yourself ready for that point where you could do it, or you hadn't done anything? And it was
not officially. So because I was actually exploring two things at the time. So I was looking at, and I think every recruitment consultant's done this who starts business, they were looking at the Tinder for recruitment. So I tried to figure out the Tinder of recruitment, the business model. Would it be worth the sales? How much you need to put into it? Which is why Finders has that name. It's a much more, you don't find many recruitment consultants or recruitment agencies with that kind of tech name, with a missing vowel in it.
So how do you spell it?
F-I-N-D-R-S, which is, it felt dead cool at the time, but now every time I give someone my email address, I'm like, oh, what have I done? I wanted to look at the app thing. I don't think I could have made it work. So I went with the agency anyway, but still kept the values there. And before it, yeah, for the 6 months running up to it, I was obsessed with the new business, and you know, I was chomping at the bit to get away, and I know I was making placements that was great to get them, those guys, into jobs and stuff, but I knew that I wouldn't see any commission for or any revenue. So I was like, I'll make doing all this work and it's not going into the business I want to build, which was
because the commission would have come later once you'd left.
Okay, so it was kind of like, never mind. But yeah, there was plenty of work that was legally allowed within the contractual means to do so.
And how did you find the process of setting up the business? Did you find that overwhelming or daunting, or you found it?
Luckily, I had a good network of people around me, including my dad, who owns his own accountancy firm. So double whammy, owns his own business and an accountancy firm. So he was great in setting up most of the stuff. And probably on the first year, I probably called him every other day. In fact, on the November that we'd started, so on our 11th month, it was his birthday. So I'd gone through all the stuff that I would have been charged by an accountant for all the services that he's done, all the hours that he's put into it. And I realized how much money I would have owed him if it hadn't been my dad.
Did that eclipse the money that he used at uni?
Yeah, it probably did. So what I did was I decided to, as a surprise, buy him a flight in a Spitfire down in Kent. And gave it to him for his birthday, which he wasn't expecting at all. So hopefully that'll keep the accountancy bill quite low for the next year. But that was really good. And I also went into a partnership with a company called SSG, who do a lot of like setup and support services for recruitment new recruitment businesses. So we went to a 4-year deal with them, which takes a lot of the time on the business management and stuff. They can do that, and I'll stick to what I'm good at, which is the growing the business and making placements.
And are you in a certain sector of recruitment?
So I've always worked in tech. Okay. So I've always worked with tech companies, primarily on technology roles and sales positions. But last year we actually pivoted and we actually changed what we do. So now we work with tech startups and do everything left to right, top to bottom. So we did HR roles, finance positions, sales, tech. pre-sales, everything, and senior search is at the top as well. So now we work as a growth partner, kind of like a hybrid of a VP of talent, an internal recruiter, and an executive search consultant, all rolled into one for one company as they grow from 50 to 100.
Oh, amazing. So you can form those really good relationships because it's just like a one-stop shop for everything the business will need.
That's it, yeah. And we very much in that sense that we don't have loads of clients. I used to have loads of clients and probably fill one or two roles at each of them every few months. Uh-huh. Whereas now we probably have five customers that we do everything for, and we end up filling more positions that way.
Oh, amazing. And with my day job, I get a lot of calls, like day in, day out, from recruitment people. You've never called. Not that I take it personally, so it's just a chance meeting. How, when you set up your new business, how do people know about you? How do you go about getting your leads and stuff in that kind of industry?
So we've, and I used to hold this really dear to my heart, that we've not made a sales call since February 2018, although that might change at the end of this crisis. So I was really lucky that I had a really good network of great people that I've worked with over the years who were all dead keen to work with Finders. So, you know, our first client, our first big client was Synity, who was recommended to us by a guy called Nick Henry, who I'd worked with in the past on a few things. And it was just very much kind of network driven in that first couple of years, very much kind of word of mouth. In the past few months, we've pushed more into the investment world. So working with VCs and PEs as they invest into those companies, and then we can umbrella into them and do their growth partnership or their growth campaign. And we also do a lot of stuff on LinkedIn as well. So a lot of marketing on there, social marketing, but then also direct messages, creating a network that way. Getting to people, know to people through there.
You are quite visible on LinkedIn, aren't you? You know, you do. You put out a lot of content.
Yeah.
You've even wrote some bits on your gaming passion, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm a massive gamer, and it's the hardest part about this crisis is that I'm trying to keep as busy as I can with work, but I know that there's a lot of people really getting some good hours in on Call of Duty Warzone, and I'm just trying to keep it to evenings and weekends, as much as my brother and my niece are playing on it all the time, kind of saying, are you coming on? So yeah, love gaming.
And you see that bit of really intriguing. You see that as a real positive, and there's a lot to take from gaming in itself, don't you?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, really true gamers will take on really difficult games. So it's really a tenacity thing. My wife doesn't get gaming at all. She just doesn't. She's played Theme Hospital recently out of sheer boredom because of the lockdown, but that's about it. And I recently played a game called Sekiro, which has been notoriously difficult. And I've been stuck on certain pieces of that game for more than a few days. And she just doesn't understand why I will just stick at something for hours on end, trying to get past a little bit so I can then spend another 30 minutes progressing. And that's very much what recruitment's like. You can be stuck at something for days on end, just doing the same thing, same search, to then finally find that perfect person for the assignment. And I think there's definitely links between gaming and that, and also being able to manage your emotions in gaming, which is sometimes hard in both, but it's definitely key.
That's insane that you take like resilience and stuff like that from gaming. Gaming is nothing I've never, ever been into. I think my soiree into gaming might have been limited at Mario Kart or something like that when the Super Nintendo came out all those years ago. That was about it, really. But I know from listening to my son, he's real all rounder, but he's absolutely in this whole Fortnite world at the minute. And it's never been an issue for me and my ex-wife, the amount he plays and stuff like that, because of the balance. But I definitely agree with that resilience. The other bit he has is, especially right now more than ever, the networking, the amount of friends through friends that he's met, who are now calling. It was his birthday yesterday, and he had all his friends and family on a Zoom call, and they're all there, so he's meeting them all and stuff like that. But hearing him, like, networking and still communicating through headsets with people, and even strategizing on some of these games that they're doing, I find it incredible. That's why I was really interested in when we sat down on the panel when you were starting to talk about that. It was absolutely fascinating. What are the with regards to the resilience? What are the like the biggest day-to-day challenges, or what's been like the hardest thing as well that you've had to deal with so far, other than this
this crisis?
Yeah.
It's probably in recruitment in the traditional sense that in some agencies they'll go through a Pareto law kind of approach, in the sense that if there's a role that you're unlikely to fill, don't work it. You know, ideally tell the client you're not going to work it, but there are some agencies out there that will say, oh yeah, we're definitely working it, but only maybe putting 20, 30 minutes into it a week. That's not our approach. Because we're a growth partner, we will work something until it's filled, and we'll keep the client updated. And we took on three assignments, which were basically rock and horse manure, closure developers in London. We'd found about a pool of about 200 people, 80% of them being contract. And we needed to get really creative on how to get these people perm. The client didn't want to take a contractor on. It had to be a perm person, had to have experience in closure. And that was probably the most difficult thing, is that we can't walk away from assignments, very much like an internal recruiter can't. So having the resilience to be able to keep going. And it, to be honest, it was Beth that managed to land this one. She managed to find a meetup of closure developers in London, cross-reference them onto LinkedIn, and then, you know, sell the opportunity to them. And we managed to get three guys into what I would have said was an impossible position just for one of them. So I'd say that was probably the biggest challenge we had, and just came down to creativity really to overcome it.
And how do you find, I couldn't do it, I'm being brutally honest, like, how do you find working with your wife now, going into business on that? I mean, when I said I could never do it, I quite like the fact that we've got different, or me and my partner, we've got different roles, and more stuff to talk about. And I genuinely find it really difficult. So I'm fascinated how it works. Do you do different roles?
Yeah, very much so. So we work very close together when she's not been furloughed, and we have the same room, but we've got two very different positions. So she does a lot of the legwork, the hard work of finding people, going through those long searches, because she can do that, have some kind of the background, and stick to a task for a long time and get progress done. I like to do much more of the customer facing stuff, so the sales, the actual interviewing of candidates, and then the big picture stuff as well. But what Beth's really good at is being the polar opposite to me in terms of that big picture stuff. So when I have an idea, she can sometimes play that devil's advocate, which of course causes flare-ups. In fact, there's an article I'm posting soon about the devil doesn't need any more advocates. But she's the one that will be that kind of quality control or that check when I want to run away with something, which is actually really useful. At the time I won't say it is, but at the moment it is. So it's really good in that sense. You know, she's quite a realistic person, whereas I'm, you know, really optimistic. And that kind of balance works really well. The kind of rule that we have, though, is that, you know, come 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock when we finish, we don't talk about work. You know, that's back to us. We'll go downstairs, we'll cook tea.
And can you do that? Like, you both can switch off?
Yeah, I mean, I have to. It's so intense when I am working that at 6, 7 o'clock, I just have to then decompress, and I will. I'll stick the Xbox on or the PS4, and she'll do something different. So it's nice in that sense. But we'll have another challenge come September, because we're expecting our first baby. So that will add another layer of complexity into that relationship. So
from speaking with loads of other people on this podcast that we're doing now, we there's definitely been this like yin and yang, light and dark, you know, like the polar opposites and sounding boards and things like that. And it's really helped. There's always this big picture thinker and someone else keeping them grounded. And yeah. I like those sounding boards. Did you have that with Beth anyway? Because she wasn't involved in the business, you wouldn't talk to her as much about the business?
I definitely would, but I think she would be, before she was much less inclined to offer her opinion, because I just don't think she felt like she knew enough to offer that opinion. Whereas now, because, you know, she's working in it day in, day out, she can offer that advice and she can offer that opinion. So it's definitely something that's developed over time. I'd say, you know, for the first 2 years when I was working, she was just really supportive. You know, if there's not many people who can support their boyfriends in handing their notice in on the day that they get the keys to a house. She was massively supportive. Whereas now it's, you know, we keep each other in check, which is, you know, we support each other in that sense.
Oh, that's incredible. And when we were discussing stuff before, we started, I can't remember what it was exactly. I mean, we were sat there just looking at an empty hall initially, and then kids came in, and we were talking about careers clearly and stuff like that. But we also got onto the subject of books and authors and things like that. So I know you've got a favourite that you're reading, or you read a lot of his stuff at the moment. Do you want to say Sam, that?
Yeah, in fact, I get a lot of people take the mick out of me because I absolutely love Simon Sinek, and I'm always using him as a reference point. And I always hear on the radio, oh, I've never even heard of the word furlough. No one had heard of it until this point. But Simon Sinek talks about it all the time in his books about there was a business that went into administration, and instead of making loads of redundancies, he made everyone go onto a furlough program where they had to take 8 weeks unpaid leave.
That was where he was talking about the guys saying, rather than the few getting hit really hard, let's have a lot getting hit very little, wasn't it? That part, yeah.
That's it. And I think he's very American in the sense that he's a little bit over the top, and he's really emotional. But there's just something about him that I do resonate with. And, you know, I read Start With Why just before Finders launched. So, you know, put all my marketing in with that kind of magic circle thing. And every time I've read one of his books, it's just come at a really good time. You know, I read Leaders Eat Last most recently, and, you know, talks about how to lead in times of crisis, which kind of we're in now.
That was the last one I read, just as this was kicking off as well.
Yeah, it's been great. But luckily, I've branched out recently, and I've started Ray Dalio's Principles book, which again has been really interesting, because you it's timing. Maybe it's just I kind of find these links for things, but timing wise it talks a lot about what happened in the market crash and how we got things really wrong in the 80s, and you think Ray Dalio is one of the most successful investors in the world now, and he's super humble, and the humility makes you learn a lot around, you know, you can come from really, really humble backgrounds twice and become someone as successful as Ray Dalio. So it's reading those kind of books, I think, is really powerful for business.
When that book was recommended to me, that is about 2 years ago, the Ray Dalio one. And the way it was recommended to me, it was through a couple of screenshots of a few pages with some things underwritten and highlighted. And I was like, this looks amazing. I saw a few of the quotes. So I ordered it, and I had no idea how big it was until it was left on the doorstep and not posted through the letterbox.
Like that.
It was daunting. So, and it's written really differently to Simon Sinek, isn't it?
Yeah.
Simon's book is definitely you could pick it up, throw it down, chuck it in your bag, carry it around. Ray Dalio's is, you can use it as a doorstop.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes into like a lot of detail sometimes about the commodities that he was investing in, like cattle and hogs and corn, and it goes into like really big detail. So, and I listen to my audiobooks when I'm on a run. So there's sometimes where I'm running, and I use it as a distraction to not think about how, you know, awful this next hill's going to be. But when you're learning about cattle and hogs and why they're a great commodity to invest in, it's kind of like, all right, you're not helping me out.
At least you're not running with the book, and it's an audio book. Yeah.
So, but no.
Nah, I get lost though with audio books on runs and stuff as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think my favourite thing about it is the part where he's talking about when he started Bridgewater for the second time, and he's in his farmhouse. And that there was about 10 people, and they would all use the kitchen as the meeting room. His kids would be on the toilet with the doors open, saying hi to the staff as they walked past. And that's the kind of business that I want Finders to be for the first few, is that, you know, I want a garden office, and I want people to feel like that family, you know, for us to really have that solid foundation. And so, you know, I'm not going to be able to afford a farmhouse after this, but certainly a garden office, I think, with the first few Finders hires, I think, will be important.
I agree with the family thing. It's exactly what we've been really trying to instill Orion and really build on that. And it just gets more challenging the more people you get. We've got like 200 plus now. So where do you see Finders going from that? I honestly don't know a great deal about how to run a recruitment business, so I don't see. Do you see that growing and your number of staff growing? And
yeah, definitely. I mean, we were supposed to be doing our first couple of hires now, but we're not.
And what hires would they have been? Would they be recruitment people themselves or back office staff? Or
so we were going to do things different to every other agency, in the terms that normally in a recruitment agency you have two options. You either go with a critical mass of 360 recruiters who pick up jobs, fill them, pick up jobs, fill them. You could have 180 people in there who half of them pick up jobs and then the other half fill the jobs. What I decided to do was actually make it into a team of three for each kind of what would be a recruitment function. So you'd have your resourcer who fills the jobs, a salesperson who goes out and finds business, and then a principal at the top who would manage process. And those three would actually work as a recruitment consultant in themselves, so that they can balance off the kind of feast and famine side. So if there's a lot of work on, they all go on to delivery. If they're coming towards the end of assignments, they can all go on to sales, and they can kind of lean on each other as they go ahead.
Oh, nice.
To try and help with that consistency. So
have you seen that model anywhere else, or is that just one you've come up with yourself?
I've just come up with it. I don't know anyone else is doing it. I've spoken to a few people in the industry, and they don't know anyone who's doing it as this kind of pod of three. So for that reason, I would the first hire we would have done would have been a salesperson. So I would have been the principal, Beth would have been the resource, and we've got a salesperson to start generating business for us towards the liberal.
How do you feel about that? Because you're essentially the face of Finders, aren't you? And then you're putting all your trust into...
Difficult. I mean, it's hard enough sometimes when I give... if I get a really good assignment, I do get really excited about it, and I want to go out there and I'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going to find all these people, and I have to... Especially when we've not got John, I'll give it to Beth to work. And it was really hard to give that part away sometimes, especially when Beth first came on. The sales bit, I love even more. You know, going out to pitches, putting recruitment documents together, proposals, all that kind of stuff. I love that part of the job. So bringing a salesperson to take that part on will be difficult, and it'll be definitely a learning curve for me to get involved with. And, you know, I'll need to take a junior person on so I can kind of hopefully teach and train that person to do it. But I know that the delegation thing is going to be something that I struggle with.
Especially because it's a bit that you love doing.
Yeah, that's it. So, but because I get to be the principal, I kind of manage those two processes. So while I don't get to do it, I do get to kind of decide how it's done. But it's not that bit that I like. I like just doing it.
And you like meeting people and doing that bit, don't you?
But for the first couple of years, I'd still come on the pitches. Yeah. You know, it'd be me and this other person. So, yeah, we'll see how we get on with that.
It's really tough because a lot of the businesses you talk to, and people always have egos to some degree. I know that there's a couple of like brand founders that we've worked with historically and do today. And they've been a startup and they've created the brand, and then they're going out to start selling it. And some, the ones that haven't worked out quite as successfully are the ones that very quickly thought, ah, I'm just going to employ someone else to go and do the sales into retailers. Yeah, if you think that there's a buyer sat down at a table and they want to understand and really buy into the story of the brand and everything else, sometimes like how you're talking about your brand's key, isn't it? So when they're sat there listening to someone else trying to sell a story about their founder, it's often a lot more potent and powerful for the founder to be there talking about where they've come from and what they've been doing. And I feel that they can get the buy-in a lot more. But if you're going to be there, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
People love your story and what you're trying to bring to the business. And that is the buy-in, isn't it?
I hope so. And that's, you know, what we found when we've gone on pitches recently, that people like that we're a bit different and the delivery model is going to be different. And, you know, they can see the extra value that we put in. But you know, most of the people that we work with, it's probably not the Finders bit that they love. It's the fact that me and Beth will go down and meet them all, and you know, we'll take them out for lunch when we do our first couple of placements and talk about, you know, their next part of their growth campaign, that kind of thing. And they like working with a couple for some reason. They like that husband-wife kind of team up, and they like the fact that, you know, when we got married last year, we sent everyone a message saying, thanks so much, you know, without you as clients, we wouldn't have been able to have such a great wedding, and you were definitely part of that. And I think people like that kind of piece more than, you know, paying a recruitment agency with a CEO somewhere, probably in Monaco or something like that. So I think there's also that kind of piece around working with a founder who's a bit more, or founders a bit more on their level.
Yeah, the gratitude piece is massive anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
I really buy into that. We do something unique and we take out suppliers and not just customers. And the hardest bit for me in my job is doing the stepping away bit. That's why I'm interested to see how you're going to handle it. Really tough.
Yeah.
And so what's the plan once Beth and you have your child? Is Beth coming back into the business after that, or is she in it for the long haul?
That's the plan so far. Whether that changes, we'll certainly see. She'll go on to maternity leave in August and probably take the year. So I've got contingencies in place in case that we do get a lot of deliveries on. So we've always worked with partners. So if we go over capacity, Amar, who I mentioned before, we're in partnership with his business. So we can split the business between and he can help with delivery of assignments. So if Beth wants to take that full time off, she can do. At the moment, she keeps saying things like, oh, well, maybe when... you know, I have some spare time, I can come in, drop in and do some work. And I kind of think that's never going to happen. But it's great that she thinks that it might be an option. So hopefully Beth will be back as soon as possible. But she can take all the time that she needs. And yeah, I think the key bit is getting this salesperson in, because I can certainly help with both sides of that.
Yeah. And so when you were just saying about like the overspill and the support of another, do a lot of agencies work together like that? Do you not get this, getting people get protective over their client base? And that
just a lot do. Unique. It's quite rare. But Amar was my first boss. So I worked with him at my first firm at Cloud International. So, and we've got a really good relationship together. So in the first year when we had overcapacity, yeah. Quite quickly, Amar came on to help us do some international placements. We split everything down the middle.
The overcapacities is that you've got the capacity to take, you've got a lot more inquiries from businesses looking for people, not yeah. an abundance of people looking for placements.
That's right. So it's businesses looking for people. So our first campaign that we took on was with a business called Synity, who needed country managers in about six different locations in Europe, and they needed them ASAP. And we didn't have the capacity to go out to Europe and fill those positions straight away. So we actually split them in half with Amar. And we made placements for head of sales roles for Sweden, France, Switzerland, Netherlands, Germany we'd already done. So, you know, we wouldn't have been able to fill all those positions straight away because it was just me at the time and we needed that kind of support. So Amar was able to come in and say, yeah, I can take three of them on and we can get, you know, pipeline on all of them straight away. Which is great to be able to lean on partnerships like that. And now we have a couple more that we're able to do. I think there are independent businesses like Finders who are a bit smaller who are happy to do it. But as they get, recruitment companies get bigger, they're a bit more in the sense that, no, we'll figure out other way to deliver it ourselves. You know, margin is king.
Yeah.
We'll deliver it at some point kind of thing.
And are they international brands then, or they've got UK head offices that you deal with, or are you dealing with people all around Europe?
We deal with people around Europe. So, you know, I think most of our positions that we've placed have been outside of the UK over the past kind of 3 years.
Seriously, I don't know about
that. Okay. Yeah, so Synity, they're a US firm, but their European head office is down in Farnborough in the UK, but they manage all their teams across Germany, Switzerland, and the rest of Europe there. So yeah, we do a lot of stuff internationally, which again is something that our clients love, that they can work with one company internationally to fill all their jobs. You know, Amar actually works in the US.
Yeah.
As a market, he lives here in Bradford, but as a market, he works the US market. So we can say to any of our customers, if you want to open up in the US, we've got a partnership that can do that for you. So you still don't need to come out of the original agreement that you like.
Yeah. And then from recruiting for Europe, are you looking geographically locally around Europe for the candidates, or are you recruiting them from the UK?
So I recruit them from the UK and then reach out to them via different means in Germany or Switzerland or wherever. So we'll get given a region where they need to be. And the flexibility, and we'll just go out and find them.
So if someone has a placement or a vacancy that they're looking to fill in Germany,
mm-hmm.
you look at candidates in Germany.
Yep.
And the reason why they do that and go through you is just for that one person to do the whole thing again, rather than go to a local agency in Germany.
Yeah, so when we took that that campaign in Vicinity where it was six head of sales across Europe, that traditionally you would have gone to an agency in Switzerland, an agency in Germany, an agency in Sweden, and you'd have to give in all the different briefs, and you'd have to go completely different commercial terms, lots of different risk, and you'd have to hope that everyone got the brief right when there might be a bit of a language difference, all that kind of stuff. Whereas we can take it all on and say, well, we'll just deliver on it all. That's a huge thing for our customers.
And you do, when you're interviewing those candidates, then you're doing that via conference calls like this, or are you flying to Europe? And
we don't go and do face-to-faces, just because it just wouldn't be viable. So we do video calls like this, telephone calls, and then the client will do a telephone interview, and then if that's all works out, we'll then fly the candidate to the client in the UK.
How do you that's insane. I had no idea that would happen in that way. How would you find the, because of different countries and different cultures and things like that, although it's only Europe sometimes, but things are slightly different. How are you finding the language barriers and different approaches to certain things?
Well, interestingly, I didn't mention this before, but I actually work predominantly in Germany while living in Leeds, so the German market, for about 2 or 3 years in my first firm. So doing all headhunting stuff, you don't get job boards and job ads out there. It's all done through headhunting and networking, that kind of thing. Luckily, the Germans are super great at speaking English and lots of other languages. So there's never really been an issue with interviewing and qualifying candidates out there. The problem we had was sometimes selling while speaking English to German people, because Germans sometimes like to buy from Germans. So there was a point where I'd learned just a little bit of German just to maybe get past the gatekeeper if we were making sales calls, or just to show that we were making the effort. And just that tiny bit of effort was a huge differentiator across everyone else that was maybe spamming into them. So yeah, it definitely was a language barrier, but you could overcome it quite quickly with just a small amount of effort.
And so if you're speaking to any European country, do you try and learn just a couple of basic phrases when you're engaging with them initially, just to try and break the ice?
Maybe. luckily, we've always done a lot of stuff in German-speaking countries. So Germany, Switzerland, Austria. I've been going to France most years since I was a kid, so I know a little bit of French. And that's probably about it. Luckily, the Nordic countries, their English is better than most people in Leeds. So we're quite lucky in that sense. But it's always good to just show that effort. And, you know, it's always a little bit embarrassing as a British person. You have to kind of make the joke on, we're the ones who don't have a second language. You'll have to speak English. But they find it funny. They're quite funny about it.
You can see it when you go on holiday, though. I've always been the kind of person that would try and make an effort of just learning phrases and giving it, even reading a menu and trying to, rather than just say what it is in English, give it a go. And it definitely goes a long way, doesn't it? I know I appreciate it. It's when part of the people say, sorry, my English is really bad. It's so much better than my Swahili, whatever it might be.
Yeah. That's what I find. And I do like the fact that I might be able to order something in German or in French, or, you know, request something. But the problem I have is that then they will then say something back in French or German, and I just go blank and think, what has that person just said? And then I have to go, sorry, my German's not that good. What did you say? Yeah. So that's always the difficulty.
It's really awkward. I always find them. So I find that we're quite ignorant, but I suppose if there's like a language that everyone's learning, you just slip into, it's not ignorance, it's a bit laziness, isn't it? I'm desperately trying to learn a bit of Spanish and go from there, just so I've got something else, I think, to offer.
Yeah, definitely. We've talked about it in with Baby Booth on the way. You know, we've said that we'd love for them to learn another language, because it's one of the key things that I always see in recruitment, that people who have a second language always manage to find jobs really quickly. It's always taken, you know, really seriously by employers. And the best way to do it is when they're really young, when they're learning one language, they can learn a second really easily. But the best way to do it is for one of the parents to speak the other language to the kids. So I don't think I can learn a language in 4 months, but we'll see.
That's the hang up. That's really hard. What you'll find is fascinating when we've been on holiday with our eldest boy, especially when we've gone on quite a few, accents are incredible. Whereas you and I would try and speak in a language probably now. In fact, I won't pull you into my bracket because I've got no idea. But it just sounds like an English person trying to speak Spanish or French. Whereas as soon as Bear starts saying something as simple as hola, it just sounds so natural. Yeah. And you're like, wow, you've picked that up. So amazing. No, I agree. Trying to do that. It's one of the things I really regret, not learning a language a bit more intently.
Yeah.
And then if people want to get in touch with you, where do they find you? I know your articles are fascinating on LinkedIn, so that's a good start, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, get in contact with us over LinkedIn. We're on there all the time, or go to our website, finders.co.uk, which is FINDRS without the E. and just send us a message. You know, we're currently helping anyone that maybe lost their job due to coronavirus. So if you need to go on our candidate plan, which is just a free outplacement service where we'll provide feedback to your CV, help you with interviews, your applications, basically works as a free career consultation every other Friday that we do it. We've got quite a few people on there, but we can take some more people on. Get in touch, or you know, if you want to do some growth hiring, if you've just received investment or ready to push the button on a new IP, you know, we can help you grow to, you know, between 10 and 20 to 100. So yeah, get in touch.
And the candidates don't have to be, or the people out there, they don't have to be based in Yorkshire or anything like that. They can be.
Nope. No, you can be based anywhere in Europe. You know, we've got people on candidate plan. We've got a Texan guy in Frankfurt at the moment. We've got another chap in the Netherlands, another chap in one of the Eastern European countries, which I should know. I think it might be in Czech Republic. So, we've got people all over. You know, recruitment's not different in different countries. We can provide feedback, advice to anyone.
And it really doesn't matter on the industry they're in either now.
No, normally our candidate plan would be for senior execs who struggle to find roles anyway in senior tech positions. But while the coronavirus crisis is going on, we've opened that up to anyone at any level.
Oh, cool. Amazing. Well, thanks for your time, Chris. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you.
Look forward to catching up soon, just so we can talk about Simon Sinek and have the little love-in.
Yeah, absolutely. Simon Sinek book club that we can start soon, the lead.
Oh, actually, before you go, did you see what he was doing on LinkedIn with his own book club?
I did, and I nearly started reading Start With Why again to watch it. So I watched his first video and see all the answers that he was answering. So I'm going to catch up on his other video soon, I think. But I'm trying to park Simon Sinek and not become too much of a cheerleader of his. So I might need to watch Ray Dalio's book club instead if he starts doing one.
Yeah, I was really interested in doing the book club with him because I thought it'd be really fascinating in a way of bringing people together a bit more. I try and encourage people that I'd given the book to give it a go. But my unread book pile, I'm like one of Amazon's best customers at the moment. It's flying, but that one was one that recently arrived, The Obstacle Is the Way, which is by Ryan Holiday, which is a really appropriate read for this time at the moment with the coronavirus.
Have you started it yet?
Yeah, I have started it. But I've read a couple of his books now as well, like Ego Is the Enemy. I can't remember the name of the other one now. But I find myself having love-ins with these authors because it all resonates at the right time. So I was big with Ryan Holiday, then it was Simon Sinek, and then it's like back to this guy again at the moment, just to give that a bash. Oh, it's amazing. But thanks again, Chris. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
All the best for the birth of baby Booth, if I don't see
Thank you.
All right. Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks.
See you, mate. Bye.